This is ILTA Radio, the source for legal technology practices and ideas to help your career delivered to fit your busy schedule. ILTA Radio, get tuned in.
Welcome to the ILTA Litigation Support Tools, Tips, and Tricks podcast series. Today on the line, we have Chris Wasserman, Special Counsel, Vice President, and I'm Ricky Broman, Litigation Support Project Manager at Saul Ewing and member of the Program Planning Council for ILTA. Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure, Ricky.
So today's topic, what we're going to discuss is incident response and how that intersects with litigation support, getting a high-level overview of what incident response is and how litigation support professionals are finding this becoming part of their job description in some instances. Chris, I know you've done a little bit in this area. Talk to me a little bit about what incident response is and, you know, where the industry is today.
Yeah, how I fell into it, coming from a lit support background, we just sort of stumbled into IR work. Yeah, it's pretty easy. So again, sort of a narrow scope that I dance in, but incident response is oftentimes, you know, there's a lot of different marketing terms around it, but in the broader scope of cybersecurity, you've got your proactive services and your reactive services, right? So this is largely from the perspective of someone like myself on the service provider side, but essentially in cybersecurity, you're either trying to prevent attacks from happening anytime you've got, like, pretty much everything that we do in the business world these days, in some way, shape, or form, we're monetizing our data somehow, right? So on the proactive side, it's largely preventative maintenance services that you're looking at in terms of protecting and hardening your systems and making sure that you have strong training and in place at your organization and good policies. And then there's a whole extra layer of that as it relates to compliance, depending on what type of industry that you're in. If you're storing protected health information for patients, if you're storing student data, if it's financial data, there's all sorts of rules and regulations that apply that can vary, you know, depending on what state you're in, what country you're in. So U.S. laws are very different than those in Europe. And then on the reactive side is largely where you're going to hear about incident response. And it's essentially exactly what it says in the name, right? There's a suspected data security, information security incident, right? And then your actual, the steps that take place once you've identified this incident make up the incident response sort of life cycle or workflow. And depending on what type of incident occurred, there's various forks in that decision tree. And where I'd say I've had the most exposure to them is largely downstream in a somewhat narrow scope as it relates to business email compromise. So what most people have probably seen or become familiar with are these phishing scams or malware attacks where someone sends you an email and it looks like it's coming from a legitimate source and you click through a link that you weren't supposed to. In some way, shape, or form, an attacker has found a way to get into your email system and is using that for any number of nefarious purposes or criminal purposes. What these attackers or hackers are trying to do when they're compromising, you know, someone's business email is they're trying to find ways to make money, and that'll either oftentimes show up as, say, wire fraud. So if I attack your system, I get in, I find out who the controller is, and I start monitoring emails coming and going, and I see that, you know, the company's about to send a request for payment for a large, you know, invoice. I'll jump in and send an email from that controller and say, hey, we've changed our wiring instructions. Please send that payment to such and such. And now all of a sudden you've got thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars being routed to a bank account in like the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands, and that money disappears. The other thing that we're seeing a lot of is harvesting of protected information, right? Attackers can sell your personally identifiable information or your health information on the black market and make some serious coin doing it. So why do we care as lit support professionals, or where does it overlap? I'd say the incident response process is a lot like the EDRM, where you've got all the steps that take place after you identify the incident. You need to do your investigation, contain it, and then respond accordingly. And in the world that I live in, it's largely identifying, once a forensic investigator has been brought to the table to identify how deep and wide the attack went, we then need to go through all of this unstructured data, the email boxes, to find out if anyone's personal or protected information was contained within that email data set and alert them. Each state has different rules about sending out physical mail notifications to the individuals whose information was exposed. And that's largely an e-discovery workflow where we have to dig through a bunch of unstructured data and identify whose info is in there, capture that information, categorize it, and then output it in a form that can be used by a separate vendor to actually send out those mailers. So, believe it or not, that's the short version of my world as it relates to IR work.
Yeah, nothing in e-discovery, incident response, or any of these technology-related fields is very simple, right? There's obviously a lot of nuances in it, and you know, as you're talking about it, it just registers with me that there's really two areas where litigation support is intersecting here, which is both as a target, right? Because we touch so much data, and there's a lot of areas where we could potentially be compromised, as well as folks that may actually help in the incident response. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, what are some of the key tools that we use in litigation support, some of the workflows that help with an incident response review and workflow?
Sure. So we primarily rely, not exclusively, but very heavily on Relativity to be sort of the engine that we rely on to get through this information. So to kind of put it into context, and it's interesting you mentioned, you know, those of us managing a lot of data for a lot of different clients, right? So at the law firm level, it's interesting, a lot of the business email compromise attacks that we work on downstream, I'd say 1 in 6, 1 in 7 are law firms that have been targeted by attackers because they do have a treasure trove of information. Why go after the end client when you can find out who their law firm is? For oftentimes it's easier to attack the law firm than it is to attack the big corporation that's housing the data, because the law firm has a copy of it somewhere.
Arguably a better target than just an individual client, right? Because you could easily expose many clients in tons of different verticals, different practice groups and everything, and get kind of your pick of the litter in terms of what data you want to use.
Exactly. And when it comes to wire fraud, right, it's law firms are sending out bills all the time. So and oftentimes it's, you know, because a bit of a stodgy industry, it's not very tech forward in general. And I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying that, but you'll see that invoices from law firms to their clients are still oftentimes being sent via email, right? Hey, here's your PDF invoice. Please send payment to this wiring address. And it's all in the form of an email. So that's ripe for the picking if you're an attacker. And I'd say that law firms are oftentimes not as well protected or have as strong of a security posture as some of the clients that they might be working for. So your Fortune 100, they spend millions and millions of dollars each year on security. I guess to answer the question, you know, we use Relativity in a number of different ways. So the way our company gets involved with these is at some point it's determined that the volume of information is too large for the forensic investigator to really navigate to identify whose information may have been exposed. And the biggest gotcha here, the biggest obstacle to overcome, is that this information is buried in email, which is unstructured. At the end of the day, in order to meet the regulatory obligations that you need to meet as a business owner, if you have people's protected information that's been exposed by law in each state, and each state has their own rules, you have to notify that individual and oftentimes follow a series of steps, provide them with some sort of credit monitoring, or at least letting them know that, hey, this information may have been exposed. And in order to do that, right, imagine you had to go through, you know, your coworker's inbox and find out every time, you know, someone's information was exposed, and that information can be in the form of, you know, the simple stuff, a driver's license, a copy of someone's passport. And sometimes it's a bit more, I'd say, esoteric, or you wouldn't think of it as being protected information, right? Certain states have laws that say if someone's full name and their date of birth was exposed, you need to notify that individual that their information was exposed. So you have to go through someone's inbox, read the emails, read the attachments, analyze them, confirm whether or not personally identifiable information exists within that document, And then you need to categorize it. What type of information? Was it a passport? Was it a driver's license? And then finally, in order to send that person a notification, you need to be able to look up their name and address. Sometimes it's within the four walls of that document and our folks can key it in. And other times it's in some other document within the same data set, or it's within another system. So that's where we start reaching out. But essentially what our workflow looks like is we grab that raw data, oftentimes in the form of a PST. We'll process it through Relativity. We'll extract out all the natives, the attachments. We'll create a big index. We'll run analytics on it. We use a lot of analytics tools like Brainspace and H5 Matter Analytics. I know some folks are using NextLP to identify entities and whittle the data set down. So we'll have maybe 100,000 documents that result from that initial set. And then we'll run our analytics, some targeted pattern matching searches, keywords that tend to float stuff up to the top. But then we still need to put eyes on this data so it gets funneled to a review team.
Right? Okay, anything still doing a linear review.
Exactly. It's a little less linear these days. I mean, after you've done enough of these, you can kind of train a lot of the AI systems to float the stuff to the top. It does start to learn over time what PII documents look like based on the tagging. So that's where the multimodal learning modules and Brainspace come in real handy. It'll start suggesting documents that might contain potentially, you know, protected information. And it does a really good job over the course of many, many, many projects. So we've run hundreds of projects through the same brain, if you will, to teach it what PII looks like, and it gets better. And like H5 Matter Analytics has its own custom algorithms that they've built that identify PII. And there's a lot of other tools out there that are similar that just float PII to the top. But yeah, it is. We throw it in front of reviewers because the reviewer needs to confirm, is this a false positive or not? Does it have PII in this document or does it not? And if it does, we need to categorize it. What type of PII? Because that needs to go into the notification. And then from there, if we do categorize it, then we need to map it to an individual, key in someone's name, full name, address, and the state they live in, because downstream, the final output, instead of it being a production, right, where we convert all this stuff to TIFF, we basically create a custom report that rolls up all that information. So you can envision like a Relativity dashboard or just the table view where you've got every single document that did have some form of PII contained within it for a particular individual. All the data that we capture about it gets rolled up into a single report that pivots on the individual name and address. And that's what our final deliverable is oftentimes to outside counsel that's helping sort of quarterback the process.
Okay, so each individual that you've identified in your data set more or less becomes, you know, an object in Relativity or whatever review platform you're working in, because I'm sure that you could use a handful of other review platforms to get the same end work product. And then you're associating the relevant information you're seeing in your data set with that particular object. And then when you spit out the report, you're getting an Excel of some sort that has all the fielded information that you've coded through the course of your review and extracted with artificial intelligence so that you can then put that in front of the attorney team to identify what notification requirements you have per state, country, you name it.
Exactly. And it's that customer, and that's why we lean pretty heavily on Relativity, largely because of how much you can extend the platform out of the box without really having to know how to code. So it's those custom objects that were the key. Like we've turned Relativity not just into, like obviously it's a review tool and we use it for that purpose, but with some of the scripts that we've been able to build that pull data from these custom objects, we've been able to turn Relativity into a data entry tool, but also a data normalization tool. Mm. And that's where the custom scripting comes into play. Taking, like you can key in a name and address on document one, right, for Ricky Bruman, and it has this social security number, this address, and it's got, you know, your driver's license, a scan of your driver's license. And then, you know, 70 docs later, we encounter something that says R. Bruman. So now we're keying that in. The reviewer is keying in R. Bruman instead of Ricky Bruman. And then the next one says Richard Bruman, right? With the scripts that we've run and leveraging the analytics the way we have against that, you know, keyed in data, it allows us to identify near matches and glue all those together and make them a single, you know, glue them together as a single entity or an individual entity, and then we roll up all the tagging information and we have ways of determining. It just allows us to perform real high quality, high accuracy quality control. And it wouldn't be that easy to do outside of relativity, or it's just relativity was a great product because it allows you to build those custom objects, link them with the data, and it comes in real handy. You know, 2-3 months later, there's oftentimes a call to an 800 number after somebody receives one of these notifications in the mail that says, hey, you're getting 3 months of free credit monitoring because such and such company believes that your driver's license number was exposed, right? Oftentimes they'll call up that 800 number and say, I want to see a copy of that document. And because we have it preserved in relativity, all we need is that individual's name. And within a matter of seconds, we can pull up the specific record that was exposed and provide it back to that end user. It's just a perfect solution, you know, if you can bend it the right way.
Yeah, and even if something happened, you know, this is dawning on me now, that even if something happens a year or even further down the line, as long as you have an archive of that database, you have all of your work products. And if you ever need to, you can dip right back into it. You see the original data. You see what is related to all of the individuals that may have been part of the breach. And you really have just kind of your work product in a nice little package that you can always reference whenever you need to.
Yeah, no one likes a class action lawsuit resulting from a data breach. But if you were to use a workflow such as this, where everything's captured inside of a relativity database, it's happened only a couple of times where the projects we've worked on have resulted in a class action suit. And often the attorneys that we're working with in the data privacy realm are not well versed in the e-discovery world. So oftentimes we're teaching them how to use relativity for the first time. But when they do go class action and, you know, the privacy attorney or the data breach attorney starts talking to the litigator in the law firm, they're like, look, we use this platform called Relativity to determine all these people whose information was exposed. And then we hear from the litigator there and we show them, you know, the database. We bring it back to life from an ARM file. And they're like, oh, all of our 90% of our work is done for us already. And they love it. You know, no one loves a class action suit, but they love the fact that they don't have to start from zero with the investigation anymore.
So we've hit on the technology that is helpful in the litigation support arena for incident response. Talk to me a little bit about the soft skills that litigation support professionals have and the intellect that you've gained as being an e-discovery professional. How is that lending toward assisting incident response workflows?
So if I were to start, you know, a standalone cybersecurity service provider firm, right, where all we did was incident response work, and I needed to dip into a pool of folks that have the right soft skills, I would be looking directly at the litigation support arena, specifically project managers in the lit support realm, mainly because they are well-versed in the jargon that attorneys use. They have years of distilling down oftentimes very complex terminology around how data is managed and translating it into terms that are useful to attorneys. We're oftentimes leaving a trail of breadcrumbs everywhere we go. There's, you know, we lit support folks treat everything that they touch as if it might be used as evidence one day. So there's a heavy emphasis on, you know, just CYA, making sure that you can, you know, walk the trail back to how you got to this decision. There's really, again, communication, organization, and then just being brought up and having that muscle memory of treating what you're doing as an investigation that you may be put on, you know, put on the stand to defend what you've done, really lends itself well to the scenarios that you run into in these incident response realms. And then you've also got the added pressure of certain types of projects. And this is unique to, I guess, anything that falls under HIPAA regulations where there's, you know, patient data at risk. It's a bit trickier. There's the scope of what would constitute protected health information is a bit broader than the definition of just standard protected info or personally identifiable information. And the Human Health Services and Office of Civil Rights, they have very, very strict deadlines regarding patient health data being breached. So if there is, and I think the clock is something like 60 days of date of discovery, like when did you discover the incident took place? You have that clock starts and it doesn't move. Doesn't matter how complicated the project is. You need to have notifications out the door in 60 days to those individuals that their health info is exposed to an attacker. And lit support folks, project managers, data processing techs, analysts, they're all familiar with those tight turnaround times and the pressure that can be applied, you know, especially from, and it's not just attorneys in these cases, it's the end clients, it's forensic investigators, it's all the different parties that you have to interact with when responding to an incident like this. Being able to deal with that pressure is not something that you find just, you know, those folks aren't just hanging out on the street corner. It really needs to be bred into them, and it's a talent that needs to be nurtured.
It sounds like you have to have a pretty cool head here too, because you know you need to be able to work well under pressure and also be able to pivot. You know, if you do end up finding that, hey, we thought we had one gig with 5K emails, but really it's we recognize that there are five additional individuals that were breached and all their mailboxes were accessed. We now have 25 gigs, resulting in upwards of, you know, 500,000 or more documents after deduping. You have a much bigger project on your hand. You have to scale it up, but you have to keep a cool head and get the resources in place to get this review done and meet your deadline. Because from what I'm hearing, that 60-day deadline, they don't care if it's 5K or 500K. They're still going to require you to plow through that data, come up with a final report, and get your notifications out.
Absolutely. And that's largely where, you know, the line in the sand is drawn, is there are only a handful of organizations out there that can meet the scale. We've had, you know, the reason I think we've been successful for so many years in providing these types of services is because we're able to, we've had projects that have come in, a lot of steps need to take place before they get to us, right? So we've had projects that come in, especially under the HIPAA, in the HIPAA world, that have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of records. We had one a couple of weeks ago where the forensic investigation that takes place before we even step in took like 40 days. Right. So there was the incident, a hospital or a hospital group got attacked, and there were something like 20 inboxes that were compromised. And it took 40 days for the forensics firm to go in and determine the scope and depth and how wide and deep the attackers got. And then there's 20 days left on the clock. And there's the whole negotiation of like, are we going to be the ones that are going to help you through the next step of identifying these individuals within this data set? So you lose 5 days in contract negotiation and data transfer. And then we have 1 million records, and we'll slice and dice as best we can with technology. But at some point, you got to start throwing bodies at the problem. So we had 3 days to get through 148,000 records. We had to put eyes on, double check, date, do the data entry. You know, in the lit support realm or in the litigation realm, where you're doing doc review for responsiveness, usually you can crank out, you know, anywhere from 35 to 50 docs an hour with a contract attorney. Right. When you have to stop on every other document and choose one of 50 tags to apply to this record and then key in the name and address of the individual whose information was exposed. And you're never looking at usually a one-to-one ratio. One document doesn't mean one entity, one individual. Sometimes you could have 7, 20, 50,000s of names on a spreadsheet. Like universities are notorious for having their entire student list with their social security numbers in a spreadsheet attached to an email. I don't know why.
Yeah, I could see how higher ed would be kind of a nightmare with this kind of stuff. Yeah,
but we had to get through, you know, almost 150,000 records. You know, we started on a Friday afternoon, and we needed to have a finished notification report available to the data breach attorneys so that they still had 4 or 5 days to analyze that information. We had to be done by Monday so that they could still do their work and then get the information off to a notification vendor.
So we've talked about a number of phases here. At a high level, who do you need at the table to have a successful incident response team? You know, you've mentioned the forensic folks. Obviously, client IT needs to be involved. It can enter into the realm of litigation support professionals helping with the processing and the actual review workflow. You'll need a review team. Talk to me at a very high level. What are the key individuals you need at the table and ready on call to implement a successful incident response or data breach incident
sure.
response workflow?
This is going to be somewhat stunted because my perspective where I sit as a service provider downstream, like how far and deep and wide I see is somewhat limited. But I can tell you a big chunk of the work that we deal with is driven by insurance, right? So a lot of the mid-market companies that are out there, right? And when I say mid-market, I'm saying higher ed, universities, hospital groups. You're not talking the Fortune 100, but you're talking like the bottom rung of the Fortune 1000 and anything that's similarly situated, right? Sometimes 10 to 20 employees up to like 10,000, but oftentimes they'll have some sort of cyber risk policy that they've purchased. And when an incident is identified, I would strongly, one, recommend do not call it a data breach, call it a data security incident. I'll circle back on why later. Usually the first call that the company makes, right, is to their in-house IT guy. Hey, I think I found something. Usually it's a third party that identifies that there's been an incident. So it could be one of your customers saying, hey, I'm getting these weird emails from you and it doesn't make sense. I think you may have something going wrong with your system. So you'll have like the in-house IT guy and hopefully they have some sort of plan for if and when something like this happens. But in terms of the actual downstream work, usually what they're going to do is call up their insurance carrier and say, hey, we believe we have an incident. And that insurance carrier is going to have a panel of providers depending on the type of incident. So on that insurance carrier's panel, they'll have ransomware, specialized firms that handle ransomware attacks. So if your data was bricked or if it was encrypted and you need someone to negotiate and send Bitcoin to the attacker to unlock it, they have panel providers that provide specifically that service. They have PR firms that they work with that help with the, you know, notifying people. Sometimes you need to do a big blast like the Capital One or the Equifax attack. They went on television or they put out a big press release saying that this happened. Sometimes that's the avenue. You'll have breach counsel or data breach attorneys, data privacy attorneys that specialize specifically in notification, right, of individuals. And so these insurance carriers will have four or five firms that they exclusively work with that they've negotiated rates with. And I'd say these folks are really important. They're going to be the ones that quarterback the entire process from you. Everything that you do with them, if you're the end client, is going to be protected under some sort of privilege claim, but they're going to be the ones that determine which providers to bring in to help with which stage. Oftentimes there's the upfront investigation, so you'll always need some sort of forensic specialist, and not an e-discovery forensic specialist. This is someone who's got specific training in cybersecurity forensics. Oftentimes you'll see DFIR, Data Forensic Incident Response, that acronym tossed about. For the folks with this skill set, they go in, they determine, you know, how deep and wide the attack was. They'll try to button it up to prevent addition, you know, if the attacker's still in the system to get that person out. And then the results of their investigation goes back to the breach counsel, the attorney that's serving as breach coach. And from there, that attorney will determine next steps. Does this constitute a notifiable event? Do we need to dig into this information? And that's when oftentimes companies like ours are brought to the table, because you'll need to do some sort of manual linear review and data mining of that information. And the forensics tools that are out there that are used by the forensic specialists oftentimes are not as well equipped as the e-discovery tools are to index and extract information across many different types of data stores. So the e-discovery tools that are out there are better suited for that large scale data mining effort. And then obviously the downstream stuff is the review. But then the last step is we would do our review, or companies like ours would do our review, send back that report to the attorney, and then they in turn would do their analysis to determine, based on the different combinations of PII found within the data set associated with each individual and which states they live in, they'll determine who gets notified, who doesn't. So they trim that list down from our report and then fire that off to a notification vendor, which not only do they send out the mailers, most of them have a call center set up and they provide some sort of credit monitoring service too. It's a lot of different hands in the till or in the cookie jar, as it would be.
Very similar to electronic discovery in this day and age, right? I mean, you often have a lot of different players at the table, and it involves a litigation support team, but obviously a lot of other folks to get the job done and get it done right, especially when you have a big data set. Chris, we're coming up on the end of this podcast. I want to get one more kind of looking forward question to you. Where do you see this industry going in the next 2 to 3 years?
Honestly, again, because I have sort of a limited, narrow view into just sort of solving the problems that we solve, as I get more into this, and what I see is these insurance companies that are ultimately having to pay for all these services, because you got to imagine having 150 reviewers in 3 days chug through, you know, almost $250,000 documents is not, it's not cheap. So as insurance companies get a bit more versed, much in the same way that large corporations started taking over procurement or vetting of service providers, I'd say, you know, 6-7 years ago, and taking it out of the hands of law firms, insurance companies are going to be the ones that drive innovation. So where I see this going is probably a heavy focus by or heavy push by those insurance companies that when they sell these cyber risk policies to, you know, their customers, they're going to probably start requiring some sort of health check or preventative maintenance measures be in place at the organization. And in return, I could see them giving, you know, much like if you're a safe driver, you don't have a whole lot of speeding tickets, you're going to get better insurance rates. I could see the industry creating a lot of solutions around preventative maintenance or a heavier focus and awareness around, you know, putting in place proactive measures to prevent this stuff from happening in the first place. And in turn, I think those organizations will not only be rewarded with, you know, having a hardened system, but also paying lower premiums to their insurance carrier for these cyber risk policies. It'll be interesting to see what sort of tools and technology come about as this becomes more of the, you know, having a security posture as privacy laws change in the United States, at least. I could see this ballooning into much in the same way big corporations may have started taking a lot of the frontline steps of the EDRM. Like they'll do their own InfoGov and LegalHold and oftentimes some of their own collection. I could see corporations taking on a lot more of the security measures in-house or paying more attention to it or increasing their budgets to protect their information. So I'd say keep an eye on the proactive side of the cybersecurity world, because the better we do there, the fewer incidents we need to respond to on the flip side.
Well, I certainly learned a lot here, Chris. I want to thank you for your time and look forward to where this industry is going and how litigation support professionals can continue to help out.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And thanks for the time, Ricky. This has been great.
Absolutely. Thanks again. And to our membership, be on the lookout for some additional tools, tips, and tricks podcasts coming up from the litigation support content coordinating team in 2020. And hope everyone has a great holiday season.
You've been listening to ILTA Radio. Subscribe to ILTA's podcasts through iTunes or Podbean and get alerted about new recordings. ILTA Radio. Get tuned in.